As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the 3-0 Show, part of the Athletic Baseball Show for Thursday, August 25th. On this episode, we have our latest special guest. It is Caitlin McGrath. She covers the Blue Jays for the Athletic. You've probably heard her on the Spin Rate podcast if you're a Jays fan, or maybe even if you're not, because it's a great show. Caitlin, thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Great timing, because we want to talk about the Blue Jays anyway. There's a lot going on with them, with the AL wildcard race. We're going to dig into that on this episode. We'll get to the NL side too. We'll talk a little bit about the pursuit of 700 home runs for Albert Pujols and some other things happening, including Josh Hader getting temporarily removed from the closer role by the Padres. But let's start with the Jays. And this is a team that I think is very dangerous, but they do have some questions on the pitching front in particular. I think it's playoff caliber pitching, but it's not necessarily elite pitching right now. Kevin Gausman, great free agent signing. Not a whole lot to dig into there. But I think one question that I haven't heard a lot of people dig into on national baseball shows is Alek Manoah and his workload. He's at 148 and two-thirds innings so far, entering play on Wednesday. I'm wondering how they're going to keep him fresh as he continues to rack up innings, because he's such an important part of this rotation when you start thinking about how they'll match up with other teams in the postseason.
Yeah, and it started to come up a little bit like in our local internal question sessions with the manager and honestly with Manoah himself. And it's really interesting what the Jays are going to do, because they don't have a ton of options to get super creative in terms of having a ton of starting pitching depth. They don't really have that. And if you look at alternatives, none of the scenarios are great, because Alek Manoah, even if he's getting fatigued down the stretch, is still a guy that's going to give you the best chance to win, I think, versus some of their alternatives. So you look at a guy like Yusei Kikuchi. Well, he's had a ton of struggles this year with Toronto, just has not been able to sustain any level of consistency. And a couple weeks ago, they made the move to put him in the bullpen for the time being. And so if you were looking at a situation where, say, you wanted to like skip a start for Alec to like get him some extra rest, like who fills that start? I mean, maybe you can slot in Kikuchi in a scenario where they're facing a team that is not so great. Blue Jays are in a stretch of schedule where they are facing some weaker opposition. They have Boston this week. I mean, the starters are set for Boston, but they have coming up the Angels, the Cubs, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. So that's maybe an opportunity where they can use Kikuchi, just try and get like four innings out of him or five innings out of him. And maybe you can get some extra rest from Manoah. After that, like, they're already using now Mitch White, who was their kind of starting depth guy they got at the deadline, to fill in for Kikuchi, who's not in the rotation anymore. And then down at the AAA level, they don't really have any great options. Max Castillo was a guy that was doing it a little bit, but they traded him at the deadline for, I think that was in the Whit Merrifield trade. So they don't have a lot of alternatives. So on the one hand, maybe it's just a situation where they're looking at Alek Manoah's starts. And if they see him having a stressful inning, maybe it's worth just pulling him from that and like not trying to have him out there in very stressful starts. And if it's more of a bullpen day, it's more of a bullpen that day. Like maybe it's just like being selectively careful. But in terms of like trying to plan rest, I think it's actually a tough thing for the Blue Jays to do right now, not just because, as I mentioned, the alternatives aren't great, but also they are playing for their playoff lives to some extent. I mean, the AL wild card looks like it's going to be very, very tight right down to the wire. So they don't really have a lot of cushion or room to play with here in terms of sacrificing any sort of game and not having your best starter out there.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's super close when it comes to the playoff odds. Yes, the Blue Jays are at 95% to make the playoffs, but that relies a lot on projected wins and projected strength, whereas right now, some of that goes out the window. Even as a numbers guy, I'm like, no, it's just, you know, about winning games. And you can almost just look at the real life, you know, leaderboard to see that the Blue Jays, Rays, and Mariners are almost all in like a virtual tie. And that if any of them falls back at all from their pace, the Orioles are right there about two or three games back. And then you've got the AL Central teams that could push you. So they really need to win every day that they can, and I think that's a good point. One thing that I might consider doing in September, I think they get an extra roster spot and two maybe.
I think it's two extra roster spots, but you can only use one on a pitcher.
Yeah. Here, the guy that I would call up is Trent Thornton. And it's not that I think that he's an amazing pitcher. It's just that they've used him in a way that's super interesting and useful for them is two inning stints. And I think that you could do a thing where you had Kikuchi for three. It's kind of keeping him between stretched out between the bullpen in the postseason. You may want to have Kikuchi for two innings, you know, so keeping him able to do two or three innings, that's useful. Trent Thornton for two innings. Now you got five innings. They might actually be good innings if you only get the best out of Kikuchi. There was a recent finding that command is actually the thing that goes away first in the course of a start. And I think that's how I understand Kikuchi, where it's like he doesn't have good command to begin with. Mm-hmm. And if you're talking about then, you know, 60, 70 pitches in, it's going to get worse. That's a bad proposition. But if you can only use a Kikuchi for like 40 pitches or 50 pitches, and then Thornton for another 30, then you might be able to get through five innings having given up, you know, two or three runs, and they have a good offense. So maybe you're not sacrificing as much, and that's a quote-unquote bullpen day, but you're keeping Kikuchi stretched out, and maybe you give Manoah a blow, but without maybe totally risking the game. But you're right, they got to win the games, and Manoah is their best option. So there isn't really someone that you can say, just call that guy up and solve that way. So,
and I would just add, if there's anyone that I think that could grind through it, it would be Manoah. Like he's been so impressive in the way that he's so seamlessly transitioned to the majors, and it doesn't feel like he shies away from any challenge
from anything.
So I don't know. I would just like if anyone would be able to get through it, and he's such a big dude as well. Like I feel like on the one hand, maybe that is exhausting because you are like a big guy. And so you're out there, and if it's a hot day, you're sweating a lot. But also, like, he's in good shape as well. And he, you know, I don't know if anyone could carry a biggest workload that he ever has in his second major league season, I would bet that he would be the guy to do it.
Yeah, you look at Alek Manoah and you kind of get the CC Sabathia vibes. You're like, this guy's going to be fine. Just keep throwing him out there every fifth day. I'm wondering if they'll maybe back off him the third time through the order a little bit down the stretch. Because if you look for the season, Alek Manoah is tied for 10th in the league in innings pitched the third time through the order. So he gets a lot of use in situations where starters typically are removed from games. And his effectiveness does fall off in that split. He's got a 15.1% K rate. That's well below what you'd expect him to get overall. And home runs become a bit of an issue for him there. So maybe the way to sort of balance things out is to get him out of the game just a little bit earlier. You're still using him every fifth day, but you're not pushing him quite as hard in each start, at least for these next few weeks, because you still got to win. You want to use him, but you don't want to overuse him maybe, just maybe, that's a solution. Let's talk about Jose Berríos, though, for a moment. It's been a weird season for him. The ERA still over 5. The whip at 137. Home runs have been a problem for Berríos overall. It's not typically something we've seen from him throughout his entire career. You know, I'll throw this to you first. Have you seen any signs of a turnaround in the underlying numbers, looking at either the pitching plus model or just overall performance?
You know, early in the season, he wasn't too far from his historical norms in terms of, you know, his stuff or his strikeouts minus walks or just the sort of underlying stuff, the underlying numbers. And so I thought, you know, he's going to turn around. He's going to turn around. Lately, though, the underlying numbers have changed, and he's put up the worst command numbers of his, recent career, basically, in terms of the four-seam and then sinker. He's really lost command of the sinker, and I do not understand what's going on there, other than he's rare among pitchers in that he has both a good four-seam and sinker. You know, they're both good pitches, and it's not really obvious that one is way better than the other. In fact, I'm not even sure which one he learned first. I would guess sinker, because of his arm slot and his curveball. So I would think that he was sinker curve. But the four seam makes the changeup better. So he needs, it's the, these four pairings that he needs all to be, in the right space. And when he loses command of the fastballs, the other pitches move a ton, so it's not like he can't use that changeup to steal strikes. And the curveball's really big. You know, it's a big breaking curveball. It's not a great pitch to use to steal strikes. So he still can fall into something where I need to throw the fastball, one of my fastballs, for a strike here. And if he can't, that's when I think he gets into trouble. At least most recently, the last two starts that were really bad were the worst location numbers for his fastballs in my model's history for him. So I don't know. Before that, I think there might have been some bad luck, and now it's maybe manifested into something larger.
Caitlin, I know you've had a chance to speak to Jose recently about this. So what is he attributing his overall struggles this season to?
Even talking to him and just like talking to people around the Jays, it feels like it is a bit confusing in that, like, they're, like Eno said, like, there are some numbers that like were very similar to what he's been doing in the past, and like some underlying numbers like spin and velocity like aren't really that much different. And I think it does really come down to the fastball command, and that is sort of when he gets into trouble. I think that's the biggest thing. And like, you know, said, it's like those other pitches, those secondary pitches, work off the fastball. And I think when we've seen him at his best, it's always been when he's locating the sinker inside off and like the fastball up usually. But it's also got to be very specific. Like I remember there was a pitch where I think it was Josh Naylor, and I think he's a good high ball hitter anyway. And so it was a pitch that was in somewhat of a good spot. It was high up, but like not against that guy. And so I think there's been some sequencing and maybe some pitch calling things that didn't go well for him as well. Like, I think that all factors in. So it's been a weird year. And I think that honestly, the gist around the Jays is that it's almost been more like confusing than concerning, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, they did sign him to a 7-year deal, and this is not the way you want that deal to start. On the other hand, he's only 28. I think he's still on the relatively young end of a pitcher, still in those prime years, I would say. And he's very athletic. Like, you see him on the mound, and the way that he fields balls, the way that he can run and all that kind of stuff. He's such an athletic type of pitcher. And so I think there's a lot of faith in that, because you're dealing with a guy that, you know, is in good shape and seems like he can get back into that good rhythm. I think the other thing is that the Blue Jays, and probably all clubs are like this, but certainly the Blue Jays, and when I've been talking to them, they're always looking for ways in which our pitchers tipping pitches. And so like that was one hypothesis with Berríos as well, is like, was he doing something, just any little thing that was giving guys, you know, a kind of hint? Especially like there was also like, I guess in the Cleveland start, which is, you know, referencing one of his worst starts of the year, was Jose Ramirez hit like a changeup that was like in the dirt, and he just completely golfed it. And so I was like, is that luck? Did he know the changeup was coming? Like all this kind of stuff. So you're kind of like wondering. So I think there's been some adjustments with Berríos where he's holding his hands and his glove, and maybe trying to hide the ball a little bit more. So just, it's not like they knew he was tipping, but like if that was possible, they want to get ahead of it as well. And so we saw him against the Yankees and he looked really good. The thing that's been confusing about Berríos this year is that he's had these really, really good starts. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I know like when, so A, he's actually been, I think the Jays have a winning record. I think he's like maybe they're like 17-6 or 17-8 or something like that when he's on the mound. So they actually are winning a lot when he's there. Sometimes it's just been like this weird coincidence where they like come back and they win these like wild games. There was a game against the Angels that they came back and won that first game of the year against Texas. They came back and won big. And so there's been some of that a little bit this year, but I think that the hard thing about Berríos and what I've tried to maybe capture, and maybe I'm continuing to try and capture about him, is that like, anytime there's been an encouraging sign, it's hard to be like, okay, he's back, because then he'll just throw in one of these clunkers. Like all of July, he was really good. And it looked like, okay, we've put the first half behind us. He is looking like the old Berríos again. And then he comes out in August and has his two worst starts of the year. And then against the Yankees, he's great. And so he's pitching on Wednesday night against the Red Sox. What Berríos is going to show up? Like that's kind of been the story of his year. Like we don't know which Berríos is going to show up.
Yeah, I think it's pretty fascinating. I think the way you described it up top, confusing rather than concerning, is where I've sort of landed on it from afar too. It just doesn't seem like enough has changed in the wrong direction for him to be quite this bad overall. Even if he's not the player he was at his peak right now, if he's a 3.75 ERA sort of pitcher, that's a lot better than what he has been to this point. Caitlin, I wanted to ask you about Ross Stripling. He is having a career year, 284 ERA, 104 whip, 80 Ks against 16 walks. And I just saw this tweet from our colleague Andy McCullough yesterday. Ross Stripling was chatting with Zach Greinke recently, and Greinke said, "Man, I really think the Blue Jays are using you right." So Stripling asked him what he meant, and Greinke said, "They don't let you go through a third time. That's perfect for you." And Stripling, kind of confused, just said, "Thank you," which knowing how Greinke talks to people, like, you can imagine that exchange was as exactly as awkward as it was shared there. But it is working really well right now for Ross Stripling. He's doing things that maybe people would have expected Berríos to do in his absolute best sort of season. So how is he doing it? And how sustainable do you think Stripling's performance is, given the way they've been careful about exposing him to a lineup that third time over?
I'll leave room for Eno to talk about this, because I think he was on a Toronto radio station recently with our friend Blake Murphy talking about probably Stripling's changeup. So I'll leave that to you. But just in terms of maybe what he's brought to the Blue Jays, I mean, at the start of the year, he was a valuable piece in that having a swing man is a valuable piece for any team. A guy that can shift from the rotation to the bullpen and do all these different roles is great. And Stripling has done that in the past, and he's been very good at doing that. But he basically had to step in almost immediately for injuries, Hyunjin Ryu mainly, early on in the year. And then when ultimately it was ruled that Hyunjin Ryu would be out for the season, Ross Stripling just took that rotation spot and ran with it, honestly. And it's funny because he's actually been a starter for the most part when he's been with Toronto. I think in the Dodgers organization, he actually pitched out of the bullpen a lot more. The situation in Toronto has just been injuries and stuff. So he's actually been mostly a starter. And this year he's really come into his own. I think it's partly that changeup that I think has been really effective this year. It's also his ability to really like game plan, but also adjust in game. Even against the Red Sox, he did that yesterday, talking about how he kind of noticed early on that the righties were getting to his away pitches. And so he kind of shifted and started pitching inside a little bit more, and that was effective. And the thing with him that's so useful is that he has all these different pitches and he can use them in basically every quadrant. He can throw different pitches to different guys. And so he keeps guys guessing a lot. And I think he's done the best job of that this year. I think that probably it's a confidence thing that's just growing. I think that there probably is an impact of not having to switch that role. I think we give so much credit to the fact that he could do it, and that's great, and he was really good at doing it. But look at what he can do when he's actually just given a consistent role. I mean, I think it's just a comfort thing. You get into a really good rhythm, and he's been huge for the Blue Jays this year. Like, you know, I think that actually, like, just to bring it back to Brios, like, I think if you're the Blue Jays, and let's just say you get into that wild card series and you have three games and you split the first two, I think there's a conversation of who's getting game three. I think that it depends on a lot of things. I think that it's probably a matchup question. It probably depends on home and away. Brios has been really actually quite good at the Rogers Center for the most part. So is Ross Stripling, but that might factor into it. It might factor into, like, a lot of different things. Who's hot? If Brios had a great September, maybe it's not much of a conversation. But if they both did, like, you actually probably want to talk about it. And maybe there's a scenario where you're using both of them, I guess, if it's a must win. But
the answer is all of them.
Yeah, everyone. Mm-hmm. But I think that, yeah, he's been really great. I mean, I would say that he's probably been, like, the unsung hero of the team. I was trying to think of it yesterday. Like, who is the guy that's, like, probably flown under the radar a little bit with the Jays, but they wouldn't be where they are without him? And I think Ross Stripling is tops that list.
Yeah, it's funny that he stepped in for Hunjin Ryu, because I remember talking to him when he was with LA, and he pointed out Hunjin Ryu as a Dodger, you know, as a teammate, as someone he modeled his game after. Mm-hmm. And we used to wonder, you know, how Ryu did it in some ways, because he was throwing 89, you know, and putting up good numbers, and Stripling's doing it the same way, and it's exactly right. He has command of all of his pitches to different quadrants. And yes, the changeup is interesting, but it's good, and it's his best pitch, and he's throwing it more often. So that's part of, like, why he's good this year. But why he's good generally is what you were saying about being able to command all his pitches to different quadrants, and that just allows you to be more, you know, make more adjustments, you know, think on the fly while you're in the game, because you can do these different things. That may be part of what Berrios's problem is that he has good command of his certain pitches to certain quadrants, and that's why he's going to throw the four seam high, even if Naylor likes the four seam high, you know, because Berrios is like, well, that's where I throw my four seam. I don't think that he has as good natural command to the four different quadrants that Stripling does. So, I think that would be an interesting discussion, but thank God the Jays have him. Like, it's, yeah, and I think that was the idea behind Mitch White too, is like, we already said, you know, thank God we have this guy, and, you know, Mitch White is, you know, a guy with options, and they did option him down at some point, but I think again with White they're saying, you know, thank God we have him, you know. So there is no talk of Ricky Tiedemann coming up.
No, I haven't heard that. I think that he's kind of slowed down a little bit.
Blowing through the minor leagues.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like, I haven't looked at it, but I think the Jays will have somewhat, I guess there'll be guys coming out. Like, Ross Stripling's a free agent, so he'll be coming off the 40-man. And it's one of those things where it's as exciting as it is, the teams also have to manage the 40-man. Yeah. And he wouldn't even have to be on it for years, right? He was only drafted
right
a couple years ago. So.
And he wouldn't have that many innings probably.
No,
he's probably running out of innings. They said that he's only doing three at a time now in the Double A.
Yeah,
but that would be exciting. It's kind of like a Shane McClanahan-esque move if they do it.
Yeah, that would be exciting. I mean, maybe there's a scenario where Pearson gets up here at some point, but he's still working his way back, and that's a whole other conversation.
He's more of a short reliever at this point.
At this point, yeah, for sure.
I think I've put Nate Pearson in the same bucket as AJ Puck was in about a year ago for the A's, where it was kind of just like, I just want to see this guy get healthy. I don't care if it's one inning at a time. Let's just see what he can do. Hopefully they can get some short relief innings out of him at some point.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's compare the Jays to the other teams that we expect to be in the AL playoff field. Because if you look at the Jays' offense, that's where they look as good as anybody else in the league. The thing that made them dangerous a year ago, the thing they're still doing really well right now, they have a lineup that does damage. It's not a lineup that strikes out a lot. It's built more in the mold of the peak Astros teams we've seen over the better part of the last 5+ years now. You know, so Caitlin, as you start to look at this team, they've got 9 hitters with a WRC plus over 100. That's with just minimum 200 plate appearances, so great depth in the lineup. And Alejandro Kirk, like, this seems real. Like, he seems like the guy that's taken a huge leap in this lineup, and people that don't follow this team, people that don't play fantasy baseball, might not be aware of who he is. But as unusual as it is when you see the height and the weight on the back of a baseball card or on a Fangraphs page, or when you see this guy play for the first time, do you believe in him the more you get to see him? Because I'm convinced that this is actually a legitimately good big league hitter and a guy that is going to be an impact bat for a long time.
Yeah, in terms of impact bat, he definitely is who he is. And I think that was the line on him as he was coming up the minor leagues. It was, this guy can hit. Like, it doesn't matter what you throw him. It doesn't matter what level he's at. He doesn't strike out much. He has a great eye at the plate. I've joked, especially when he was like on his tear, like earlier in the season, kind of leading into the All-Star game, which he ultimately made. But I sort of joked, like, Alejandro Kirk should just call his own balls and strikes because his eye is so good up there. And yeah, like, he slowed down a little bit. I think he was just so incredible for the middle portion of the season, I guess, that it was bound to come down a little bit. And certainly then pitchers take notice and start to pitch him differently. So he's definitely slowed down a little bit. But yeah, he's been, again, another guy where the Blue Jays wouldn't be without his bat, especially when some other guys weren't performing to their peak levels. He really carried them for a while there. And he's inserted himself in a situation where they're using him as much as possible. So if he's not catching, he's often DHing. I would wonder if maybe some of the slowing down is attributing to, again, some fatigue level. He's still pretty young. This is his first full, I mean, he was in the majors last year, but he missed some time with injury. So this is his first real full test at the major league level. And he's taken on a lot, especially early on when Jansen was hurt. Jansen's been hurt quite a bit this year. And so Kirk has been taking a huge load in terms of the catching. And so I'm sure there's some level of fatigue, but he looks good again. Like, he just when you need a big hit, he seems to come through more often than not. And the thing that I've talked to players about him and what they like about him is this, he just does like all the little things well. Like, if you need to hit the other way, he can do it. He makes a lot of contact. He can hit sacrifice fly when you need that. Like, he can do all those like little baseball things that like sometimes maybe don't get a ton of attention like in the box score, but like other players on your team always notice that you're able to do that. You're able to make the right play when it matters. And so I think that's been really encouraging. The offense was obviously almost always going to be a thing with him, I think, but defensively, he's looked really good. I think his framing has really improved. I think I've heard a lot of people talk about his framing, especially on like low pitches, has been really effective. And defensively, he's probably still got some work throwing out and game calling and all that kind of stuff. But he's still so young. I think he's only 23, so he's still got a lot of time to sort of learn those ins and outs. And for catchers, I think the game calling stuff, especially at the major league level, is probably the hardest to learn. I think it just takes a ton of reps to be able to do that. So, but I think overall the Jays have been so impressed with what he's been able to do this year. And I think he's the real deal.
You know, I want to ask you about Bo Bichette, because this isn't the season many of us were expecting from him. Strikeout rate has jumped up to a career worst 24.6%, but he's still making a lot of hard contact. If you're looking at him and hoping for a late season rebound back to his pre-2022 power output, especially, is that still on the table?
I think one thing that's really hurt him is the new ball. You know, they it's not like a completely new ball because they were using it last year, but this year they're using it 100% of the time, and it's a deadened ball. He's an opposite field hitter at heart, and opposite field barrels and opposite field fly balls don't do as well as pulled fly balls. He's obviously learned to pull the ball over time, but I just think those natural tendencies towards going opposite field have hurt him in the power department. And then on top of that, just a poor sense of the zone, I think, or maybe just a poor sense of like his ability to do damage on pitches outside of the zone. He thinks he can take those pitches and do something with them. And in the past, he's been able to. So hopefully there's a learning process, because as you see, he's chasing balls outside the zone less than he has in the past. And that's the main place that I'm looking for him to improve going forward. A little more patience, a little more sense of the zone, because he still barrels the ball well, still makes good contact. I don't know what's going on in the base pass for him this year. It's a little strange that he seems to have lost after being a 90% effective base runner, trying to steal bases. This year, he's been caught as many times as he's taken off. That's a little strange to me. But there's a lot of the stuff is there still for him to have a second chapter in his career that's as good as his first. I just need him to kind of improve his plate decisions.
I almost wonder if it's the curse of a great hit tool. You can get to pitches that you shouldn't be able to hit, so then you swing at those pitches and make a lot of weak contact on those particular pitches, and that drags down the overall production. You know, thinking about this Jays team, how they stack up to the Yankees and the Astros. They're 4-2 against the Astros this season. They've already played the Yankees 16 times. They went 7-9 against them so far. Caitlin, what's the gap between the Jays and the Yankees, if there is one? Like, what would be the biggest difficulty in matching up with those top two teams in the AL if they meet with the Jays in the postseason?
I actually think the Jays at their best kind of match up well against the Yankees. It's strange, like, the Jays have almost more so struggled with pitchers that have more junk ball stuff in some ways. Like, the Jays have struggled against left-handers, which has kind of been a weird thing because they are a stacked right-handed lineup. But for whatever reason this year, they have just not been able to do damage against left-handed starters for the most part. But I think overall just left-handed pitchers to the extent that you would think, which is funny, like why the conversation about like them balancing their lineup and getting a left-handed hitter was like funny. Cause on the way, like, I think that it would be still effective because it makes the opposition pitch differently. Or if you've got to mix it up and you're not just facing right-handers, and the Jays right-handers also all profile kind of very similar. So if you threw in like a left-handed bat, but at the same time, like they hit righties really well. Like it's left-handers that they don't hit great right now. But honestly, like the Jays have always handled Gerrit Cole really well. They handled Frankie Montas really well the other night. They kind of match up well against some of the Yankees starters, I think, in that I think they can hit velocity. They can hit that kind of stuff. So I think at their best offensively, they kind of match up well against the Yankees. I would have said earlier in the season that the bullpen is a difference maker, but I think the Yankees bullpen isn't as scary as it once looked. You know, Chapman's been a bit of a wild card. Clay Holmes, I guess, has struggled. I think he's coming back from the IL soon, but I don't know. Like, I think that the Yankees bullpen, I don't know if it's taken a step back or if it's just like the weird like ups and downs that a bullpen naturally goes through. It might be that. So I would say like earlier in the season, that would have been the difference maker for me, because I think the lineups profile similarly. I don't know if the Yankees, if the Jays is a little bit deeper, but only so much if they're all going. And we've seen the Jays be very streaky this year as strong and as good as the numbers are overall for their offense. We'll see periods where they just don't look like that at all. It's been weird, and I think the players haven't really been able to figure it out, or maybe they have theories, but even like last night talking to Chapman, Matt Chapman, he was just saying like, you know, there's no real rhyme or reason why our team has been streaky, but we haven't just had this like huge month. They've had like huge 2 weeks, and then they kind of look so-so, and then they don't look so good, and then they all of a sudden look amazing. So it's been one of those weird years. And so I think the most important thing for the for the Jays heading into the postseason is just to get in that good rhythm and have all things clicking at the same time. Because I think honestly, when all things are clicking at the same time for them, like they match up really well against anyone. Like Houston's going to be tough. I would say like Houston, I would pick them as the best team out of the AL. I think that's probably not a controversial opinion right now, but like their bullpen's really good. Their starting pitching is really good and they have a really, really dangerous lineup. And I would say I would fear them against the Jays because I think that they have all aspects of the roster clicking and they're really good. But yeah, I think like the Yankees, I don't know, like to me watching the Jays play them recently in New York, like granted the Yankees were not doing well at that time and the Jays were performing pretty well coming out of their own slump. But I just kind of like the way they match up against them and the Jays, you know, Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah and Ross Stripling, like, they've pitched well against the Yankees this year. Berríos has as well. So I think the starting pitching is pretty even between those two teams. And yeah, the bullpen might be the difference maker. The Jays, they don't have a lot of guys that just have wipeout strikeout stuff. That's sort of the limitation with the Jays. So we saw that in that last game in the Yankees series where Adam Simber, who doesn't give up a lot of home runs, but when he does, they go pretty far. And so that was kind of the difference in that game. But the bullpen, honestly, for the Jays, they've been performing pretty well, doing what they can do, and being able to keep the ball in the ballpark most of the time. But having that lack of strikeout stuff is a little bit concerning for the postseason.
Yeah, I think you're right to point out the bullpens. You know, I think bullpens are like the biggest source of chaos when it comes to predicting how a team will do in the next 3 weeks, 4 weeks. I think maybe one of the biggest sources of chaos year to year and you know, in all of baseball, you know, bullpens and injuries. I think those are the two biggest sources of chaos. And the reason I think about this a lot for the Yankees, and I think you kind of talked about this, but I thought the Yankees had, like, maybe the best bullpen in the game. Like, if you'd asked me, like, literally a month ago, I might have said that. You know, like, before Michael King went down and going into the season, you know, early in the season, Michael King, Chad Green, Aroldis Chapman, Clay Holmes, like they just throw power arm after power arm at you with strikeouts and sinkers and four seamers, and you know it's like, and then they go and get like an E-Frost, and you're like, oh man, like this is a great bullpen, and like I'm like, it's like 2 weeks since the trade deadline, I'm like, who's gonna close this game out?
I know.
They leave Clark Schmidt out for three innings to like. I mean, I like Clark Schmidt, but that's not who I thought would close the game out. You know, they're not even going to go to Chapman, and it's Willie Peralta. And like, so that's when like people ask us to make predictions. And, you know, when we, you know, have a segment on sizing up the contenders, and when we try to prognosticate, we try to think about the future. The dumbest, weirdest thing is always trying to figure out what a bullpen is going to look like. Because I think the Astros bullpen looks good. They could have maybe one or two injuries. I mean, Presley's knees have been hurt, you know. They could have Presley's knee act up. He gets it drained. He's still trying to be out there, but the command goes. And then maybe Stanek goes down to injury. And Neris gets one of his wild, you know, hairs up his nose where he doesn't have any command. And then all of a sudden you're like, God, this Astros bullpen. What were we thinking? Is this a good bullpen at all? I think that's what separates some of these teams. I would take some of the starting pitching over the non-Verlander part of the Astros, starting rotation. So if Berríos could get right, there is a possibility that the Blue Jays lose game one to Verlander and then win the other games, you know. So I think that the class of the AL, and I may not include the winner of the Central in this at all. And I think the class of the AL is Toronto, Houston, and New York.
Yeah.
I think you could make a case for the Jays as being that third team, a very strong case. A big part of why we're talking about them so much on the show today, because I think they've been overshadowed all season by the Yankees having such a huge lead in the division. And that lead has been whittled away over the last 7 or 8 weeks or so now. I mean, the Yankees, they're not playing great baseball right now. They did just take a two-game series from the Mets. Probably a big step in the right direction because they're headed to Oakland for a four-game series that starts on Thursday. Then they head down for a 3-game set against the Angels, you could really end August on a high note and get that gap back up to, you know, 10 plus games if you're the Yankees. Mm-hmm. They're still almost certainly going to win the division, but they're just close enough now where the Yankees fans can sweat it out. And from afar, I love to see that. But the good news here for that bullpen, Clay Holmes should be back from the IL soon. Scott Efros also should be back relatively soon. And it sounds like for the rotation, Luis Severino is making pretty good progress trying to get back from the 60-day IL. He's eligible to return in mid-September. He was throwing 95 to 97 in a bullpen session on Tuesday. I saw that note from Marley Rivera over at ESPN. So I think if Severino is healthy, he's a huge difference maker for the Yankees. I mean, because he can go out and win games for you in October and take some of the pressure off that bullpen, which has had its depth really eroded with a lot of injuries. The other thing with the Yankees that's kind of a wild card for me, Giancarlo Stanton, supposed to come back for the start of that series against Oakland. I was surprised looking at his line just earlier today. He's hitting .228 with a .309 OBP and a .498 slugging percentage. It'd be the worst slash line, I believe, of Stanton's entire career if that holds, but he's still hitting the ball really hard. The plate skills still look pretty good. I think we're going to get good Giancarlo Stanton, and that's going to be a nice boost for the Yankees as well. So I know there's always that sort of palpable panic in the air when things start to get wobbly for the Yankees, but they can really do a lot here in the next 10 days to really right the ship.
Don't forget to adjust for the new offensive reality of baseball in 2022.
Yeah.
That line that you just mentioned may not sound super exciting, but it's almost 30% better than league average.
Jeez. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's pretty awful.
He still looks like the same Stanton, the guy that hits the ridiculous missile home runs that are barely like above your shoulders. I mean, just he looks right. So I think coming off this Achilles injury, that's a big boost for them. But the AL wildcard race is better than expected, in part because I think the Mariners kind of put themselves on the same level as the AL East clubs. I think when you added Luis Castillo at the trade deadline, they became a lot more interesting. They've got a young team that's really clicked all season long. The Rays are playing really well right now. I think we mentioned that maybe a week or two ago as a team that still looked pretty dangerous on paper, especially with their pitching. So as they get maybe healthier with their position players, that bodes really well. And then we still got the Orioles hanging around. They're 64-58 entering play on Wednesday. I already feel terrible about my prediction that the Red Sox would still hold on to win more games than the Orioles, because the Orioles have things working right now. They're only 2.5 games
Orioles.
Back. You did. You were on the Orioles. I think it was the week that Katie Wu was on the show with us. You both were smart and took the Orioles, and I said, no, come on, the Red Sox aren't this bad. Well, maybe they are.
You can actually, on the playoff odds page on Fangraphs, you can change it so that you can see the 7-day change in playoff odds. And the Red Sox in the last 7 days have subtracted 11% from their playoff odds.
Love that. Pretty much since the time of that prediction, that's what they've done. So really, really good work on my part. But look, the Orioles are just 2.5 games behind the Jays and the Mariners. Do you think the other teams in the playoff race are taking the Orioles more seriously than many of us have throughout this season, Caitlin? Because they've been a pesky team all year, and it just seems they keep getting more and more confident the further into the season that they stay within arm's reach of a playoff spot.
They're a contender at this point, honestly. Like, I don't think you can take them lightly. Like, I think I would still probably bet on them not making the postseason, just given like the teams that they're competing with, and like the Rays and the Mariners and the Jays are probably in the best position to take those three wild card spots. But I think that they can't be taken lightly. If anything, they can be a disruptor. They can be a spoiler. They can maybe impact the positions of those wildcard teams. Most impactful for the Jays, because they have a lot of games left against them still. There's a 4-game series coming up. And then I know the Jays end the season in Baltimore as well, which could be super impactful. Like, the Jays could be playing for playoff position up to the last day of the season, and maybe the Orioles are still in it at that point and they're playing for their playoff lives. Who knows? So I think they're a really pesky team. That's a good way to describe them. Defensively, they're quite good. They've improved a lot in that regard. And offensively, they have a good lineup. And honestly, even last year, like, they could hit. I remember watching their team last year and thinking, like, oh, they can put up some runs. I remember they for whatever reason, just hit Robbie Ray really well, which was like kind of strange because no one else hit him well last year, except for the Orioles, essentially. But they could kind of put up runs in bunches a little bit. Maybe their offense was a bit streakier last year than it's been this year. I think it's probably taken a step in the right direction with some of those young rookies coming up, Adley Rutschman being sort of the main guy that's kind of gotten to them to this point, I think, and has been sort of the guy that's ignited this second half surge for them. But their last year, their pitching was just so awful. Like, it was really did them in consistently. I mean, I was there in Baltimore when the Jays scored like 22 runs in a game against them and like 44 runs over like three games or whatever it was. Crazy. And so they just had no pitching last year, starting or the bullpen. This year, their starting is still kind of meh. I think so, overall, I think their numbers have been better lately, but their bullpen is just great. Like, they have a few guys, especially the back end of their bullpen, their leverage guys are really, really good. And so, like, when the Jays play them, it's like, you better put up runs early or it's going to be hard to hit that bullpen. Like, Bautista's just a huge human. I saw him the other day. He was doing like a hit, like with MLB Network or something like that. And so he was standing on the Jays side where the camera is. And I was just like, that guy is like one of the biggest guys I've ever seen in my life. And I'm around Alek Manoah a lot. So they've been such a pesky team. I think like they're a tougher matchup for the Jays, honestly, than the Yankees are in some regard. Cause like I said, like the Orioles pitching is more crafty. They're good at sort of like keeping the Jays off balance because of the stuff that they have. Whereas again, like with the Yankees, it's like they've got Cole just like throwing hard and the Jays can handle that. And so a couple days ago, or I guess a week or so ago, like the Jays were in their worst fits of the year and they lost, I think, four or five straight to the Orioles. And then they finally kind of erupted in this one game. Ross Stripling had a perfect game until the seventh inning, and the Jays scored like six runs that really got them going. And they've sort of been on a high ever since then. But like those games, they have this easy stretch where I said they play like the Angels and the Cubs and the Pirates, and then they go to Baltimore for four. Like, those four games are going to be crucial. I don't know where the Jays will be in the standings at that point. I don't know if the Orioles will maybe fall off a little bit before we get there, but looking ahead to those four games, one's going to be a doubleheader because a rainout happened. But like, we might be in a situation where like the Jays and the Orioles could like trade position in those four games if the Orioles are still only like two games back or something.
Yeah, the Orioles, it's really weird. I was going to say, you know, their big chance is to flip-flop with the Rays, but they don't play the Rays anymore. And the Orioles' non-division schedule is fairly light, except for, I think, six against the Astros. They do get some Tigers and some A's, it's really weird that they don't play the Rays anymore. They're done playing the Rays. So I think that's kind of meaningful because that's the place where I would give the Orioles the best chance to flip-flop. But instead, it's going to be the Blue Jays because they have all those games against the Blue Jays. And the Rays can kind of, if the Orioles are going to play spoiler, the Rays can kind of float above that. And all of a sudden, the Blue Jays might be playing for the third wild card, and that's tough too because the seeding means that they wouldn't get a home playoff game. So
and the Jays have a lot of games left against the Rays too. They still have a makeup game from the start of the year, so they have a series at home, I think, that's four games, which includes a doubleheader, and then I think they go to Tampa again for four games. So I believe they still have eight games left against the Rays. Yeah. And then I guess it's, what, seven games against the Orioles left?
Yeah, and it's weird because this is where strength of schedule numbers can kind of be deceiving. So it says that the Blue Jays have the best strength of schedule among the Rays and the Orioles. But the problem it says that is because partially, they're looking at the projections for the Orioles and saying there's this team is projected to be below 500. So they have so many games against the Orioles that actually pushes their strength of schedule, rest of season strength of schedule, to 485, right? And so that, I think, is deceptive because maybe the rest of season projection for the Orioles aren't catching up to how good the actual Orioles are. And so, yeah. You know, I think because you can see they're projecting a 400 team out of the Orioles, 407. And that would affect the Blue Jays' strength of schedule. But the reality is this team looks like a decent team, the Orioles. So it's going to come down to how the Blue Jays do the Orioles, I think, for their whole season.
Yeah, which is crazy. Like, there's actually 10 games left. I just looked. I forgot about a home series against. So the Jays still have 10 games against the Baltimore Orioles, which, like, in April we were looking at that, like, okay, here's how they can beef up their wins. But no, that's not the story anymore. Tough. I mean, maybe they can. I mean, maybe it does even out. Maybe the Jays do just figure out the Baltimore Orioles by September and they do string off a lot of wins against them. But yeah, there's a week in September where the Jays have that 4-game series against Tampa, or is it 5 games? Is it 5? Oh, it's 5 games against Tampa with that doubleheader in there. And then 3 games against Baltimore. Like, that week in September is basically like make or break their playoff lives, I feel like.
Yeah, that's a really important stretch.
The Mariners' rest of season schedule. Oh, man, it's a bit of a cakewalk.
Easy.
It is so easy. I mean, I don't mean to insult the Guardians, but the Guardians are probably the best team they're playing. They play the Padres for 2 and the Braves for 3, but outside of that, it's a lot of Angels, White Sox, Tigers, Athletics, Royals, Rangers, Athletics again, Tigers. They finish with 4 against the Tigers, my lord. Maybe the Mariners will be in the number 1 spot in the wild card. I hadn't looked at that schedule before.
Oh, yeah. It's like, I think it's, I guess a good thing, if you're going to put a glass half full on this for the Blue Jays and spin it this way, is that their schedule is going to test them so much that if they can get through it, it feels like they'll be playoff ready. At the same time, maybe you don't want to be peaking at that point just to get into the playoffs. It's weird. It's like, I don't know. Like, I don't know if the Jays will be like necessarily like fighting for that playoff lives. Maybe they're good enough to like get one of those 3 spots, but it certainly feels like it's going to come down to the wire in terms of who they're going to play, what seed they're going to have. And as you say, if they're going to have those home games or not. And the 1-2 is going to be kind of huge because it potentially is a Toronto to Seattle trip or Seattle to Toronto trip. And that's big. Like, it's one thing if it's the Rays, it's pretty easy to get to Tampa from Toronto. It's not a huge travel day, but making that cross-continent trip to Seattle, that's huge.
That is borne out by the numbers. In fact, one of the biggest sources of home field advantage is how many time zones the opposing team had to cross before they got to you. So, yeah, that is absolutely a truth. For me, I find it a lot easier to go west than to go east, but that's just I can't go to bed earlier. I can go to bed later, but I can't go to bed earlier. but that's neither here nor there. But I do think, you know, I do think that travel would be a big deal. And it is also, I think when we flash forward to the shows where we have to prognosticate over the postseason and people are talking about, oh, well, you know, this team had a better record than this team. You kind of have to remember how those records were won, you know, and what opponents, you know, they beat. And, you know, maybe the Mariners will be the number one wild card, but maybe not the best wild card team.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. That's why you have to kind of sometimes look at some of the components about how good is the offense actually, how good is the starting rotation actually, how good is the bullpen actually, because wins, I know wins are the final currency, you know, but they aren't necessarily the number one way to determine how good a team is.
Yeah, the AL East seems to be the best test to see who the best teams are in terms of, at this point, you don't really have a weak team in the division, quite honestly, whereas in the AL West, you can kind of beat up on the Angels and the Rangers a little bit. And even in the Central is just
the Royals and Tigers aren't happy with this. Yeah, and even the best teams there, you know, are would be wild card contenders at best, you know.
Yeah, and I've been confused by the Twins. Sorry, I've been confused by the Twins. I thought they had that wrapped up. I don't know what's been happening with them lately. I was there a couple weeks ago. They played the Jays really well, and they've kind of fallen off a cliff since then.
Buxton injury, some weakness in the pen, I think, you know. It's also injuries. Not like, you know, compare the Twins to the Yankees, and I mean, or the Blue Jays. It's, they're not built as strongly. It's just, you kind of did player by player. You'd be like, oh, I'll take the Blue Jay. You know what I mean? Like, where are the positions where you take the Twin, you know?
Yeah, maybe a couple of relievers here and there, but like, their starting pitching, I think, is still a real big weakness for them.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
Let's take a quick look at the NL side, where I was very surprised to see this already pop up, but the Padres temporarily removed Josh Hader from the closer role, so they're giving him a little break. He hasn't pitched since Friday. We're recording this kind of midday Wednesday. It's been a pretty long break for him. Command just has not been there. This is a Padres team that immediately after their trade deadline binge, it seemed like all the momentum in the world was behind them, and that has been pretty quickly lost. And part of it is having breakdowns in the late innings. That's definitely an issue that they have dealt with. And you look at this NL wildcard race, I mean, between the Padres, the Phillies, and the Brewers, you've got three teams for two spots, because I think we're all pretty comfortable penciling in the loser of the NL East division race as an easy wild card. Mets, Braves, whoever doesn't win the division is clearly better than those other three teams. I look at this Padres team and I know they're improved. I just wonder if they're not going to take advantage of everything they were able to do, because the emotional loss of not getting Tatis back, that seems like a pretty big deal on top of some other things that are starting to happen to this club. So, you know, are the panicking members of Padres Twitter, are they actually right to be as worried as they are right now, despite all the moves that San Diego made just a few weeks back?
I mean, it takes a lot of winning to clean out the ghosts, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, to some extent, I think this is like almost relevant to, you know, to the Blue Jays. It's like you kind of, there's always this like, are they good enough? Are they good enough? Until they are, you know, until they just finally, you know, answer the questions, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, I don't blame fans for asking questions. Like, you know, Ken and Dennis and I wrote a whole, you know, trying to empty out those ghosts and trying to see like what happened. It was one of the worst collapses in baseball history last year. And so they, you know, they're like, well, we saw this last year, you know, like, you know, what is it going to, it's just going to happen again, you know? At the same time, I would say that they are a very good team, even without Tatis, and that Hader is a very good pitcher that just hit some bumps in the road with command. I think, you know, he's done this before where he's just can't find the plate for a little bit and then he's fine again. I would think he's going to be fine again. If you want to give him a little bit of space to find the plate again on a, in the eighth inning or something, then that's okay. But I'm not saying that a collapse is happening right now. Like I don't see that happening in real time. I think the Phillies, Brewers, and Padres are all equally strong teams with equal flaws. The Brewers' offense is a flaw. The Phillies' defense and bullpen is a flaw. The Padres' offense is a bit of a flaw, but they worked really hard to better it. More hard to better their problem than maybe any of the other three, the other two teams. The Phillies did go get Brandon Marsh and Edwin Sosa to try and, and David Robertson to try to deal with their issues. The Brewers...
nope, not really, not no. much.
No, but
I think of all of these three teams, if you want to like quantify reasonable worry, I think Brewers fans have the right to be the most concerned. I think it's the most justified there. I think the Phillies and Padres look a tick better to me. I think even without Tatis coming back, that Padres offense should find its stride. I do think Hader is fixable. And I think Bryce Harper coming back for the Phillies, they've weathered the absence of Bryce Harper better than many people expected them to. I think that gives them a massive boost here in the near future. So
it's fair to question. So the Brewers fired Andy Haynes and they were like, oh yeah, ostensibly by firing Andy Haynes saying we can coach our hitters to be better hitters. It's there's some coaching things that are going on here. I don't know, man. They're still not great hitters. You even found some hitters. Like Rowdy Tellez wasn't even playing. Was he playing for them last year or did they acquire him?
Yep, it was
like
last
at the end
year.
Of the season. But
it was mid-season for Trevor Richards.
Yeah.
That base swap. Yeah.
But all I'm saying is they found a hitter and they still need more hitting. mm-hmm. And they keep trying and they found Willie Adames and they keep trying and then I don't know. They either their acquisition model for hitters is flawed or maybe their new coach is not as good. I mean, I have all the respect for Andy Haynes. I don't think it was his fault, is my point. They're still having trouble hitting.
That division it shouldn't be that hard to hit in that division.
And that park.
Yeah.
No, 100% agree. I think it's a classic example of the hitting coach being the scapegoat for expectations for the club not being met. That happens a lot. Hitting coaches and pitching coaches often take the axe as a result of a team falling just short. The other big story in the NL right now has to be Albert Pujols, though. The recent home run binge he's on gives him a shot. It is at least a shot at 700 home runs by the end of the season. I didn't think that was possible at all. In fact, I remember last year when the Angels parted ways with Albert Pujols and the Dodgers swooped in to add him to their roster, I remember laughing about that, thinking, what on earth are they doing? This is a really smart team. Why would they bring in Albert Pujols? And we learned pretty quickly, using him mostly against lefties in a part-time role and then the value he was bringing to the clubhouse, it actually was a great decision by the Dodgers to do that. Despite seeing that success, I thought, okay, this is it for Pujols. Comes back to St. Louis. Yeah. I thought, okay, yeah, sure. Maybe by the middle of the season, Pujols is off the roster and it's truly the end of the road. Now, here we are sitting here on August 24th in that part-time role, 14 homers, a .277, .352, .529 line for Pujols. We've turned back the clock from a slash line perspective pretty much a decade. I realize he was an everyday player the last time he was at this level, but this is remarkable if this is happening. It's the sort of thing that we don't get to see very often with Hall of Fame caliber players who are often just kind of pushed out with an unceremonious release or are playing once or twice a week on a bad team. This is a guy that's actually coming up with clutch plate appearances on a team that will probably win its division and could do a lot of damage in October. It's one of the best baseball stories of the year, and probably one of the most unexpected ones, too.
The line that I look at is versus lefties this year, he has a .398 average, a .436 on base percentage, and an .807 slugging. That's a 1.2 OPS. Against righties this year, he has a .186 average, a .289 OBP, and a .322 slugging. If you're an opposing manager, why on earth do you ever let Albert Pujols hit against your lefty? I guess it would have to, those, the first couple of appearances against the starter or something. But If you have any opportunity to turn the pitcher around on Albert Pujols, please do that in the future. Otherwise, he's going to keep smacking these homers. But I love round numbers. I love, you know, I was a big fan of Frank Thomas because he always had the 400 on base percentage and the 500 slugging at least, you know. You know, I love those round numbers. I love that he's on a chase for 700 homers, and he now has a chance to do it. He just needs 7 homers. He's projected for 4. You know, he just needs to outdo his projections by 3 homers, and, you know, he's got a whole of 5 weeks to do it. I'm super into that, you know, because I do actually believe him. I don't think he wants to come back, you know, for a half season to try and hit a 700 homer. I think he wants to, you know, hit that one into the night in a Cardinals win and push them, you know, into the playoffs.
Yeah, I think, like, it wouldn't even be as special if he came back for, like, a month or two next year just to get 700. It kind of takes away from it. I think what gives that number and, like, that milestone significance is doing it during basically his career. So obviously he's already kind of extended his career this year. I think maybe there were some questions if he would come back this year, and it was the perfect fit with the Cardinals. It's that storybook story, and the way that they've been playing now, somewhat separating themselves in that central division, it looks like they're going to be in a good position to win that division, I think. As we were just talking about the Brewers not being, you know, as good as they could be with the offense. So it just is a perfect storybook ending to his career, to the journey with the Cardinals. And like I said, I mean, I don't even follow the NL that closely, and I'm sort of peeking over and seeing if he's going to do it. I remember being in Toronto last year with Cabrera hitting his 500. And it happened late in the season, and it's a different scenario because the Tigers didn't have really much to root for that year. So it's just kind of about him and those milestones. So it's actually even more fun when you have the Cardinals, like, they're rooting to win the division, or their fans are rooting to win the division. They've got a good team. They look like they're going to be strong heading into the postseason. They've got all these good stories now with, like, Jordan Montgomery being amazing since he got traded there and all this other stuff. And then, like, on top of that, you've got, like, a legend trying to hit this, like, amazing milestone that would just, like, be the cherry on top of what's been a really good season there, especially in the second half.
Yeah, starting to feel like one of those seasons for the Cardinals, which, as someone that has rooted against them for a long time, I know that feeling all too well, but it really is a great story. 5 straight seasons of being a below average hitter when, you know, that was really the only thing that Albert could offer, and then to bounce back to this level is really amazing. So I'm actually hoping he gets there. I hope he gets to 700 by the end of the season.
He's so slow that the third baseman can stand like 4 or 5 steps back from where he normally stands. And all the infielders can do the same, basically. And that basically eradicates singles for him. So what he's doing is even more impressive to me. Like, that's why I kind of love analytics. It's like, that's like a dorky thing, right? But it tells you that, like, the teams are doing something that totally eradicates singles for him. And he's still hitting over 300 against lefties. You know, like, he's still doing so well when all he can do is walk or hit a homer. You know, so I think the numbers all just add to the story and make it even more fun.
Yeah, absolutely. We need to go. Before we go, a quick few things to pass along. Give Caitlin a follow on Twitter at Caitlin C. McGrath. That's very important. The C is very important. You got to spell Caitlin right, too. It'll be in the show notes. If you don't follow her already, find Eno on Twitter at Eno Saris. You can find me at Derek Van Riper. If you don't have a subscription to The Athletic, you can get one for $1 a month for the first 6 months at theathletic.com/baseball show. That's all of our team coverage, all of our coverage heading into the postseason. And of course, if you play fantasy football, you're excited about football season or other sports, we got that covered right now as well. That's going to do it for this episode of The Athletic Baseball Show. We are back with you on Friday.
3 is the magic number.